Friends, Chris Sauter, lead pastor at Neighborhood Church. We work hard at creating content every week that is life-giving and inspiring for people to live a full life. So we're inviting people who find this stream to be life-giving and encouraging to consider becoming a sustaining member at Neighborhood Church. That could be a one-time gift or to subscribe monthly. And you can do that at neighborhoodchurchmn.org. Thank you, friends, and enjoy the message. I was just, honestly, I told Sarah before, I'm like, well, I hope no one sees my pants because I'm pretty sure I don't match. This does not match, right?
I can't tell.
You can't tell. Yeah, neither am I. I'm an optimist, so in my mind, the world is always sunny. I'm like, of course this matches. But my daughter, she's the one to ask. All right. Thank you, Sarah. That was great. That Christmas carol-ish reminded me of that we have our Advent series coming up soon. And Sarah and I are actually talking after the service on what we're thinking for our Christmas Eve service and how we're going. What? Oh, Sarah's pretending to be excited, so that's awesome.
Not pretending to be excited, I'm excited.
It'll be really good. All right, so you can see our theme this year, I can tell you in advance, is called Honest Advent. It's going to be good. Because so often when it comes to Christmas, we feel, well, I should feel this way, I have to be excited. Yes, all these plastic little pictures of white Jesus should be inspiring, all those things. But if we're honest when it comes to Christmas, we're honest when it comes to Advent, we might have more questions than we have answers. And when you can be present, not instead of, oh, I have to be okay with my family, right? Christmas is one of those times where like, I don't think I'm okay with my family, or I have to be okay showing up into a large family gathering during a pandemic. Or you might be feeling, I'm grieving that I can't show up in a pandemic. So when you're honest about Christmas, instead of just fitting into that role, it allows you to have some sort of wonder. It allows you to have some sort of curiosity. And so we're excited. So today I'm talking about, I labeled this rivers, cries, and something else, right? But here's what we're talking about. We're in our series called Inspiration, Inspired, because I believe the Bible is not just a book full of rules. It is definitely not basic instructions before leaving Earth. It is a messy, beautiful, complicated, inspiring, sacred word that is to help us be able to see for generations and generations of what is our origin stories, who was the people of God, and how can we use wisdom? How can we inspire to continue to transcend, to continue to evolve? And today, I thought we'd talk about Moses, right? And Moses is a great story. But before we get onto that, there's two things that are really important that we hit on. The first is this. It is so easy for speakers, and dare I say, even pastors. Yes, I happen to be one of those as well. And you hear the word pastor? Like if I'm hanging out with a group of people and we're talking and someone goes, well, what do you do? And I'm like, well, you know, I'm a pastor. Everyone just goes, wah, wah, right? And usually like, I'm sorry for swearing, whatever it might be, right? But here's something pastors do so often. They will steal people's words. They will steal people's work and claim it for their own, right? And I imagine I have been guilty of that as well. But there's something that I heard recently that really did inspire me that I wanted to share along with you. And it's easy to take little things and make it your own. This is strictly, I heard this and I felt so moved that I want to share. And the work is from a woman named Kelly Nicandia. And she wrote a book called Defiant, What the Women of Exodus Teach Us. And I heard her speak at a conference virtually called the Evolving Faith Conference, Evolving Faith. And I love that conference. I believe in it. And what she shared, it's serious. Like the whole idea of this series, like what inspires us to continue to evolve, it inspired me. And so if there's anything you find moving in here, if there's anything you find inspiring in here, please look up Kelly Nakandia, right, in the book Defiant, and then you can get so much more. So I thank her for her work. Here's the second thing, right? The second thing is this. It is easy, and we should, when we read the Bible, to be able to read David and Goliath and then to feel like we might be a David, right? And all I have is a couple stones and a slingshot, and I have these giants in my life, whether it be addiction, it might be mental illness, it might be a coworker, whatever it might be, right? And I have to be able to overcome these giants. When you read the story of Hagar, and there is this disenfranchised, enslaved woman, right, running into the woods, and there's a God who sees her and pursues her, and she's the first person named God. Right? You might identify with Hagar. You might identify with Ruth. You might identify as Joseph being left behind by his family, by his brothers into this pit to die. You might identify with the blind man, right? Where Jesus kneels down, right? Kneels down, gets close to him and touches him, puts mud on his eyes. You might feel like no one's willing to touch me, right? Those are inspiring, and that is part of the Bible. But we'd be doing the scriptures horrible injustice if we weren't aware of something else, is that the Bible was written by oppressed, marginalized brown people, right? The Bible is written by enslaved people who had these moments of inspiration where they found this freedom and then went into exile where they lost everything. It is a common story over and over and over again. So yes, we can be inspired by those characters, but we also have to remember that we are people in a historical context, right? Like this is like tangible, like flesh, blood, amazing hair, living in Esco, living in Jordan, living, right, with your cat number 5. Like you are a real person. And when we go back and say, oh yeah, I know what it feels like to be Moses, I know what it feels like to be a Hagar, I might just say for probably a lot of us, right, we might not be able to identify with the marginalized people. You might be able to be inspired by them. But instead, where we might identify more is part of dominant culture, right? In fact, we probably can more relate to the empire, the people who had the power, the people who had the privilege, the people who had the platform or the voice. And we don't always like to identify with them in the Bible. Why? Because the empire exploited people, right? Rome exploited people. Pharaoh exploited people. But if we're not able to actually see where we're at in that narrative, then we'll never learn. Then we'll never be able to see that what we can do with our power, with our opportunities, with our privilege, with our voice. Because in election year, all right, I know you're like, oh, great, roll my eyes. But here's what happens in elections. People in power who want power, all right? And this is both card-carrying conservatives and loony liberals, whatever word you want to use for it, life-giving liberals, I'll make it a positive one, right? Is whoever is in power or is asserting for power, they will use shortcuts to get a desired result. This is why I say yelling gets the shoes on, right? When you have little kids and you want to get to TGI Fridays, get you some of those chicken strips as soon as possible, you are going to start yelling at your kids to get their shoes on, because then the kids will start going, and they'll get their shoes on. It is the fastest route to it. But the consequence is an undesired result, right? You might get the shoes, but then you have a kid who lives in fear. Or you have a kid that you teach this is how it looks like to be a man or to be a woman or to be a person, right? It's not what we want. And those in power then will also use the same tactics. Every election cycle, it's very similar. You're going to hear things, and I identify as Christian, and so you're going to hear some of these things from both sides. They're going to say, well, you know, if this person is voted in, if this party's voted in, they're going to come for your guns, right? They're going to come for your rights. They're going to come for your God or for your church or your religious right. And let me just for a second. And the truth is, right, in my lived experience, I'm going to share about this in a little bit. You might feel like they are coming for your rights. But let me just speak to Christianity, and let me even just speak. I don't identify, this might be shocking to some of you, I don't identify as an evangelical Christian. I identify as a Christian. And what I see a lot of evangelicals do is around this time, is I heard them say, use those words, that same fear, right? Of like, I'm being persecuted. So let's just talk about that for a second, because that plays into our story of Moses. because someone might question your religious beliefs, because someone might say, well, why do you believe that policy? Or does your church really do that? Why would you give money to that organization? What do you believe about God when it says X, Y, and Z? A lot of people will take questioning or holding a mirror of what you believe as persecution. Friends, that is not persecution. That is what we call having a healthy dialogue. That's called people interested or want to have an intellectual conversation about why you believe what you believe, right? This is even what I believe I'm pretty sure it's Peter says, have ready defense about what you believe, right? That's a normal thing. Instead, when people hold a mirror up to us as Christians, it's easy for us to start feeling insecure, because if you're part of a dominant society, if all the people around you believe the same thing, and they say, well, why would you allow that? Or why would you exclude that? Or why would you include that? We're like, oh, you're persecuting me, right? I've heard people on social media, people that I know, saying, well, they're going to come for our churches, and they're going to rip down our churches. I saw a sign on Highway 33 at a rally saying these God-hating, and named a political party after that. And I'm like, what is going on? How did we get there? And here's why. Because when you use fear and use the words persecution, then it gives a platform for that person to feel validated in their response. It gives them a place of saying, no, I have power. But when we do that we're able to strip away our power. We're able to strip away of our responsibility, of our historical place in context to the empire, to the system, right? And when we identify, when we use those words, then we're literally taking away from people who are being persecuted. Of all the Muslims being persecuted in China, being put into those labor camps right now because of their faith, for the people who are being persecuted or excluded and even killed for identifying as queer, for the people, the black trans lives that is trending, right? We're able to say, oh, no, like, no, I'm really being persecuted. For the Christians who are literally being persecuted of their faith overseas, to identify in this, like, oh, I feel you because you can't wear your WWJD shirt to work, right? I've heard people say, well, you know, we took prayer out of schools. We never took prayer out of schools. Students and kids can pray at any time they want. Right? But we use that as a way to validate us. And the reason, usually like what speakers are supposed to do is save these big points for the end to keep you engaged, right? I want it at the front because when we read the story of Moses, you're going to hear some of, you want to identify with Moses. You want to identify with the Hebrew women. You're going to want to identify, and you should be inspired by them. And we don't always get excited about identifying with Pharaoh. But if we don't see it, then we'll just repeat it over and over again. So where we start, Exodus 1. I'm going to be paraphrasing this story. I encourage you to go back and read it. And here's a couple things working against us we have movies and books that talk about Moses that might have already filled in your gaps. I had a book as a kid. It was a giant like Bible storybook where Moses and Pharaoh are all white. It's just fascinating to me, right? But like, and I remember reading that story and I love it. I can still smell that book. We have Prince of Egypt from Disney. We have Charles Heston? We have some guy with perfect white teeth who plays Moses, right? And they fill in that narrative. We're like, oh, but if you go back and read the story in Exodus chapter 1 and 2, and this is what Kelly Nakamia did for me, is help reimagine the story. So where it starts with this is we have Joseph. Joseph was left behind by his brothers in a pit to die. And then a slave owner comes, trader comes, picks him up, takes him back to Pharaoh, back to the kingdom. And he finds favor with the king through interpreting dreams. And he's able to store all this food so that when there's a famine, they can live. And because of that, the Hebrew people are welcomed in and they find life and they find voice. Exodus 1, it says, there was a new king and a new Pharaoh. And right from there, the authors are trying to communicate something of what once was, right? Whatever happened before with Joseph and how they found favor and how they found promise and how they found all these things, they're saying there is something new in the air. And it starts with this king, this Pharaoh, saying, looking at the Hebrew people, and they have multiplied and they have grown. And he looks at him, he says two things. He goes, whoa, what if these people, these Hebrew people, join our enemies, right? Then he goes, well, actually, what if, worse yet, they just get up and leave? So at the very beginning, with this new king, this new Pharaoh, this new way of seeing, this new way of being human, The Pharaoh, the empire, and the king tells us two things about the Hebrew people. They are viewed as a threat, or they're viewed to be exploited. Because if they leave, well, we can't use their bodies for our pleasure. We can't use their bodies for our work. We can't use and enslave these people to get what we want. And what do they want? Empire always wants more. So what this Pharaoh does, he says, these people are only to be exploited. Not like the previous king who looked at Joseph, who looked at the people as something to seen as human, as valuable, as a voice. These are people to be exploited. So the empire enslaves all of them and puts them into hard labor and to make more of these huge storage, really kind of cities, these places, so that when famine happens again, right, they can survive. And instead of including other people, they could go and exploit other people, because from the very beginning, what the empire views is something to be exploited. But something happens here, right? These Hebrew people have heard the story of Abraham. They've heard the story of Joseph. They heard the story of Noah. They've heard the story of the magical tree and the talking serpent and what could happen, what could be. They heard the story of how this God created the heavens and the earth and said that it was good. It's something inside of them, right? And there's this liberation song that begins to be sung amongst the Hebrew people, even though the empire is like their boot is on their throat. And they continue to grow. And so the Pharaoh gets like concerned, right? Like, I'm exploiting you. I'm using you, but you keep growing. So he has this great idea. And he calls in two Hebrew women, two Hebrew midwives. And there's something that you need to understand. Again, this story and the Bible was updated and translated and added to and taken away over thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of years. But one thing that remained in all those different hands, those different stories, is this. They never name who Pharaoh is. But the people who are named are two Hebrew midwives, and their names are Sephara and Pua. The authors want you to know, yeah, we're happy for this Pharaoh, but who starts the revolution? Who is singing this liberation song? Yeah, learn the names of these amazing women. And Pharaoh brings them in and says, hey, you're getting too strong. I know you're the midwives. And so I want you, if there's a girl that's born to the Hebrew mom, I want you to keep the girl. But if it's a boy, I want you to kill this boy, right? I want you to kill. That's what you should do. Because why? This is what empire wants, and we know what's best. And so we're telling you. And what the Hebrew women do is they're like, okay, they go back and they don't do it. They don't. They don't kill the babies. They let them live. And so Pharaoh, a little boy there, brings him back in and he's dumbfounded. He's like, what are you doing? I told you to do this. Those with the power, the empire has deemed you to do this, right? And they have this amazing line. You go back and read it. And they said, oh, Pharaoh, we're not like these Egyptian women, right? Which is this line. Which is this line of saying, how you view the world, how you view what it means to be human, we see it differently. And we're not going to play by those rules. We're not going to operate in that way. You might be able to hurt us, own us. You might be able to try taking the breath out of us, but we're still going to sing this liberation song. And because of that, it says that God favored them and even added more to their numbers. I love that. We're not like these Egyptian women. You don't even know us. And here, these two women, these two Hebrew midwives, they start the very first time we see of civic unrest, of saying, we're gonna be a part of freedom, we're gonna be a part of transformation, and there is this liberation song that we're singing, and you are not gonna be able to stop it. And it's interesting, right? Because what Pharaoh does, there's two things. The first thing he does, and this is very normal for those in power, for the empire, to go back to the oppressed and say, hey, no, you have to deal with the problem yourself. That's not our responsibility. You have to take care of this population problem. So we're gonna ask the oppressed people to police the oppressed people, right? And just throw out a common example, right? You might have heard of like, they will go up to people of color or will go up to black people and say, well, what about all this black and black crime? What are you doing about it? Right? You ever heard that before? So often those in the dominant culture will look at those who are oppressed and marginalized and say, no, that's your problem. You should go deal with it. And that's exactly what Pharaoh does. And the women are like, no, you don't know us. We're not like your Egyptian women. We are strong, full of moxie and resilience, and there's a freedom coming. Love that, right? So then what does power do? Then they legislate. Pharaoh turns around and looks at the people, his citizens, and says, all right, then if you're not going to do it, I'm now going to incriminate everybody. I'm going to invite all Egyptians, everyone in my empire. If you see that a Hebrew woman is pregnant and it's a girl, let her live. It's a boy, throw it in the Nile, is what he says. And that's exactly what power does. It says, well, if you can't police it yourself, then we're just going to involve everyone else and make it a normal thing. We're going to normalize this murder. We're going to normalize, right, this behavior, this view of you, your bodies are something to be dispensed of. Which is fascinating, because you can imagine there's probably a lot of people in that culture that said, yeah, of course, that's how we view the world. That's how we view humans, right? I imagine there's a lot of other people who are like, no, I don't agree with that, which we'll find. We're going to see what happens. So then the story moves to a Levite woman meets a Levite man, and they have a little Levite baby. And where they don't have a baby, they're pregnant. And you can imagine, and this is where Kelly Nakandia, again, the woman who wrote that book and shared this story, this is where she begins to reimagine a story that deeply moved me. And she said, like, she finds out she's pregnant, and you can imagine there's great joy and wonder of what could be, and at the same time, there's deep trauma. Because if it's a girl, it gets the baby gets the lip. It's a boy, it's going to be killed. So the time comes to deliver the baby, and the midwives show up because that's what they do. And you can imagine as the baby is being born, there is this celebration, there is this joy, there is this release of life. But then the room changes when they see that's a boy. Went from celebration to loss. From this something to celebrate to something already lost. And it says that the woman looked at the baby. The baby doesn't have a name yet. And said that she saw the tov. She saw the goodness. And tov is this word, right? It's the same word. Tov is the word in the story of the magical tree and the talking serpent. Even be bigger than that is a story of this God who creates the heavens and the seas. And it says it is tov. When it creates the plants and the animals, looks and says it is tov. When it creates the human body, it looks at it and says this is tov. It is good. And the goodness was just not in Adam or Eve or in the platypus, right? The goodness was in between that animal and the land and the people. It's when there's rightness between, when all things are made right, or as Radiohead says, everything is in its right place. It's in that space that it's good. And that same truth, that same kingdom principle, that same life, this woman sees it in Moses. It says this goodness, this promise, things will be put in the right place through this baby. This baby's not just good, it's going to bring the tov, the rightness between the land and the people and Pharaoh, the people and the divine, right? Why? Because liberation, friends. It started with those Hebrew midwives. They're saying, we're singing this song, and it went to this woman, and now they see it in the life of this baby. So for 3 months, this mother hides her baby. And you can imagine as she goes down to the Nile to wash or to work, she's doing what she does. And she looks up and across the Nile, she sees where the empire is, right? There's a Nile, there's a river between them. And she could see that Pharaoh's daughter comes down to wash. And all her maids are there. And there is this plan, there is this movement, there is this song that begins to take even more form. And the mom begins to imagine of what if I could put this baby into that place? What if this baby, this tovness, this rightness could be seen by this woman? And I've never thought about it this way before. Because in the story that I read, it always was the mom would put the baby in the basket, make sure it's waterproof, and then just threw it in the river and watched it float away, just hoping that somewhere someone would take care of this baby. But there's nowhere in the Bible that it says that. In fact, what it says is that she gets the baby and puts pitch, like the story of Noah and the ark, right? There is this ark where there's life, this promise. And she crosses with her younger daughter and crosses the Nile. This is where Kelly Nakandia helps reimagine it. Of she puts her own life at risk of snakes, of alligators, of currents. And she crosses. Why? Because that's what healthy people do. I want the next generation to hear the song. I want freedom. I'll do it at any cost. And she goes and says that they put the basket in the reeds. And her sister, this baby's sister, is right there with her. And what happens is all of a sudden, the women of Pharaoh's daughter and her maids hear this cry. And the cry is important. Because what they wouldn't have heard babies' cries too often. Because imagine what washed up on their side of Nile, what washed up on where they were cleaning, where they're doing their work, wasn't anything that could still cry anymore. So to hear a cry was something different. To hear a cry was something of life. And the maid hears it and brings it to Pharaoh's daughter. And Pharaoh's daughter opens up the basket. And in there is this baby. And clearly this Pharaoh's daughter saw the tov. Something stood out because she says, I choose life, right? And she names the baby Moses. And that is the first name we hear of Moses. And it's called to be pulled out, to be withdrawn out. And something is made right in this. She notices something different. And she says, this baby is going to live. And all of a sudden, out of the reeds comes Moses' sister that was planted there. And she goes, do you want me to find a Hebrew woman to nurse this baby? And Pharaoh's daughter says, yes, and I will pay her. Okay, let's stop there. Think about what is happening here. On the other side of the Nile, there is this woman who's excited with this life. Then there's this deep-seated trauma and this tragedy. She sees that the empire, the power, has just crossed the river and hatches a plan of what if, and goes through all this work, puts her life and Moses' life and Moses' sister's life in danger just to place that basket in the reeds, hoping that someone at some point would hear this cry. And who hears it? The empire. And when they see Moses, they see this baby, something changes, because now across the river is now there is life instead of something to be exploited. Something across the other river is something that could bring forth joy, that could bring forth some sort of change. There is at least some sort of leveling of the playing fields to say, at least I will pay you, because you don't pay those who exploit. And it's beginning, that freedom song, that liberation song becomes louder and louder. And if you're able to play this out and reimagine this story, right? Pharaoh's daughter would have to maybe possibly cross the Nile to go back to bring this baby back to the place to its mom to be nursed. And there she would have heard the stories. She would have seen the people and their work. She would have heard the songs. She would have been a part of learning their names and learning their heritage. All of that, right? And what leads to it? Moses, when he gets older, will let my people go in freedom. But somewhere between the river and when he gets older, someone was still teaching him that liberation song. Someone was still teaching what it means of those Hebrew midwives saying, we're not like your Egyptian women. Someone had to continue that story. Someone had to continue that song. So this is what I invite you into. You might identify with the Hebrew women. You might find inspiration. You might identify with maybe Moses, right? But for a lot of us in dominant culture, we probably can identify more with Pharaoh's daughter. And because here's what's happened. The people who are oppressed and marginalized, they have to do the work to get someone to hear their cry. And how many women, how many people who were oppressed before this moment cried out to Pharaoh, cried out to the empire, and never heard their voice? And here there is one that was written down, one that was passed on to generation and generation. But Moses' mom still had to do the work. And all Pharaoh's daughter had to do was be willing to hear, be willing to listen, and willing to move. My encouragement is to you is this. This is what inspired me. This is what Kelly Nakandia inspired me, is how often, as a person with privilege, as a person as part of the dominant culture, do I not hear the voices of the oppressed? Because we can read the story and say, oh yes, it was so bad, and there's people in need, people enslaved. Do we not hear the voices of marginalized today? I was talking to one of my friends. We talk politics. And there was this comment in the Supreme Court during a ruling that happened a couple weeks ago where it came to a tie or a push, I don't know what you call it in the Supreme Court. And two of the justices made some sort of comment and said they believed of what it means for the queer community to be able to marry one another and have like equal rights to marriage. They said, I think that was not the correct interpretation of the law. Which of course led to the LGBT community as feeling, well, what does that mean? If there is a different case that comes up in the road, now not just their healthcare, but who they can marry and how they love. And I brought this up to one of my friends. We talk politics, and he takes a different space than I do. He's more conservative, I'm more progressive, I'm better looking. And he said, well, what does the queer community have to be afraid of or concerned of? And instantly, I was already getting ready for this message. I was like, you don't hear the cry. I didn't say this to him. I'm like, you don't hear the cries of the people. Because your ability to marry, your ability to love, your ability to have access to healthcare is not going to be dependent on some Supreme Court's ruling, right? If it's never been dependent on that, that's what we call privilege. You are part of the power of the system of dominant culture. And I'm like, you can do your own work, friend. You can Google in the same way I can Google. I know you know people who you're concerned about this. All you have to do is be willing to hear. All you have to do is be willing to listen to the cry. Non-dominant culture, people who maybe aren't as abled as us. This is something I've been thinking about. Of like me walking to my favorite store, me when I used to go to stores or restaurants, right? Me being able to walk into different places, me being able to go to a state park. Did people who are in walkers or wheelchairs, people who don't have the same access to their body as I do, can they go and enjoy all the same things? Are we aware of the cries of our friends? I was talking to a former college friend of mine, and they were sharing of they have a child who has special needs and just how hard it is. How beautiful it is, but how hard it is. I started thinking, I remember having a conversation with someone 4 or 5 years ago when we planted the church who had a son with Downs, and in our kids program, they were having some harder access to things. And I remember hearing that and just being like, oh, okay. And now I'm embarrassed by my reaction. I didn't hear the cries of someone who was different than me. Do we hear the cries of the people who are hungry? In Carlton County, I imagine everywhere else, there's over 300 families every single month who are looking for food. Do we hear the cries of the indigenous people? I got to listen to a panel of people of color sharing about what it means to have white allies. Mike and Melissa Hendricks, Mike Valdez put this on. They brought in the panel of speakers who are all people of color, and for 2.5 hours shared about what does it look like for them to have a white ally. And one guy, one indigenous man who's the elder of the group, who works in social services, his name's Len. I'm pretty sure it's Len. And correct me, I'm sorry if I'm wrong. But Len said that stood out to me. He goes, all I'm asking for my white friends is just to be courageous. Because all of us, we're courageous every single day. We show up to work and it's a white culture. And we have to be courageous and show up to be able to see you, to hear your story, and to function in your culture. I show up to a bait shop, it's a white-owned business. I have to change and be courageous to show up and to move and to act and behave in how you expect me to behave. I show up to a restaurant and just name like corporation and place over and over again. He goes, all I'm asking is that you be courageous too. Can you show up and see me as an indigenous man? Can you show up and hear my story? Can you see my needs? Can you see my threats? Can you hear my cries? Man, that stuck with me. Can we? Yeah. And what we do so often, those of us with privilege, those of us in the dominant culture, we can like hear of what happened with the protests in George Floyd, what we see what's happening in Philadelphia this past weekend, right? And we can like disassociate with a big backup and say, oh, I'm exhausted. I don't want to hear any more about it. Only those with privilege can we take off that jacket of concern or ally, because it costs us too much emotional health. That we just hang it up on there and say, I need to walk away from it. I need to take a break from this. That, my friend, is privilege. Because the people of color in Philadelphia and around the nation don't have that option. If we're willing to hear the cries, if you can see that you're a part of the empire, and here's the thing. So many people, when they hear this, they're like, well, then I have to hate being an American. I have to hate being white. Not at all. Pharaoh's daughter never says, I can't believe I'm part of this empire. Oh, boo-hoo. No, no, no. She sees what she can do with the power and privilege that was given to her, that she was born into. She realizes the access she has, the Hebrew people didn't, and she uses it for liberation, friends, and you can do the same. So here's where I end. I wrap up with this. This inspired me and reminded me of the story, Matthew 20, of the vineyard owner, when Jesus shares the parable. And there's a vineyard owner who needs some work. He goes and hires this place where all these workers are at. And he says, will you work for X amount of dollars? And they say, yes. He brings them. He goes back a couple hours later, hires more. Goes back a couple hours later, hires more. And they're all working. And minutes before the vineyard's about to close down, he brings in a couple more people. And minutes after that, he goes and he goes, time to wrap up, close up shop. And he goes and he starts paying people who've worked the longest. He goes, hey, I'll pay you what we agreed upon. Pays the first people that worked the 12 hours. And the people who worked like maybe the 8 hours, pays them the same amount of money. The people who worked 4 hours, same amount of money. People who worked minutes, same amount of money. And the people at the beginning, they say, whoa, 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 whoa. That's not how it works. We did it right. We have a way of doing. We have a way of being. We've done this for hours. We did it right. We should get more because we've been here longer. These people just walked in. These people just got seen. These people just showed up. And here's what Jesus is saying, is if we can start of a place of inclusion, if we can start out of a place of that we're all connected and we all belong, if we can start out of a place of what we see is not I'm better or I've been here longer or our dominant culture is better or our way and our values, our way of seeing God, our way of worshiping, our faith, our votes, our values, whatever it might be, is not better than we are all in the same place and we're all connected and we are all loved. And if you can start with that, when you can start in that place of seeing your brother, your sister, or your non-binary friend as not as an enemy, not as someone's less than, but someone is to be loved. Think of the transformation that can come out of that. And here, Pharaoh's daughter saw her place in history, or not history, but saw her place in the power. And across the river was not someone who was less than, not someone who was to be exploited or owned. It was someone to be seen and someone to hear their cries. Friends, we can do the same. I'm going to pray. So God, yeah, I guess what I feel is where I start is I thank you that you hear my cry. And as cheesy as that sounds, today I feel that. That you can hear my cry, you can see my need, you can see my hurt, you can hear my pain, my fear. Instead of casting me off of like God Island, cast me off of like loved or beloved island, what you say is I'm included. What you say is I already belong. And even though people that I've loved, it says, no, Chris, you don't belong. You don't count. You're wrong. The whole time you've said over and over and said, Chris, you are beloved and I am yours and you are mine. So I pray for my friends who just need to hear that. And not just hear it, but receive it. Holy Spirit, will you come? And we welcome that. And I pray for those of us who are part of dominant culture. I pray for us who we see that we're part of the bigger empire. Will you help us be able to hear the cries of those around us? And where we have built up resistance, where we've built up judgment, where we've built up resentment, I pray, God, we can just like stone by stone, wall by wall, we can just begin to push those aside. And we can maybe for the first time or maybe for the 100th time, we can look across the Nile. Instead of seeing a problem, instead of saying you have to deal with it, we can see our brothers and our sisters and our friends as equals to be loved and to be heard and to be believed. And I pray for those who are oppressed, who are pushed to the margins, who are saying you don't count, who are saying your love doesn't count, who are saying your bodies don't count. I ask for wisdom. I ask for strength. I ask for that same liberation song that Sapphira and Pua heard of saying, we're not like you. We're different. And different isn't bad, but different in who what we embody and who we are is beautiful. It is strong. And God has favor on us. I pray for my friends, they would hear and feel and live and embody the favor of the kingdom of God. Because liberation and freedom and life is worth it. So we trust you and we love you, God. Amen. Ooh, I like that. I like that a lot. I do. I like. Yeah. So, thank you for being in this space with me, friends. And if there's anything we can do to add value or be with you or in your corner in the next 2 days or next couple weeks, please feel free to reach out. Have a great rest of your weekend.